Ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? It's okay, I see a wave. Welcome to the 23rd Lewis H. Durham Memorial Lecture. I'm Joe Thomas. I'm the Dean of Cornell's Johnson School of Management. It's really a cool job. You are here to listen to Paul Pullman talk about sustainable business models for the 21st century. And I want to take a few minutes relating the history of the Durham Lecture and to do a couple other very quick things. First, the Durham Lecture Memorial Fund was established and endowed in 1983 by individual and corporate donors who were friends of Lou Durham. Roy Park Sr., some of you may have known Roy, was among those. Lou was Cornell class of 1930, and he was Cornell University treasurer for over 25 years. The Durham Lecture is the Johnson School's most prestigious speaking event. I would like to recognize Lou Durham's wife, who is now married to Frank Collier, Frank and Barbara Collier, who come to every one of these, and I'll tell you something really important about them in a minute. But first, let me just point to them and ask you to give them a round of applause. And I'm probably going to make you applaud again in a minute because of the other thing that I'm going to announce, which is that Frank and Barbara have given to Cornell's Johnson School the funds to establish a new Cornell professorship in honor of Lou Durham, the Lou H. Durham Professor of Management in Cornell's Johnson School. We use endowed chairs to attract many outstanding faculty. I was talking with a couple people before about Andrew Caroli, who we attracted here with another chair. Before you applaud, let me also say, I am going to ask you to do that, that we have in the room the person that we have attracted to the Johnson School, who is coming to us from Illinois, who holds an endowed chair there and is coming to be the first person in the Durham professorship. And it still is pending the Board of Trustees vote, but I bet they approve it. So please help me thank Frank and Barbara again, and welcome Murillo Campello, the first Durham professor. Donations such as this make Cornell and the Johnson School what it is. It is the margin for excellence. It really allows us to attract great people. Unilever is an important corporate partner of Johnson School and Cornell. There are roughly 90 Cornellians at Unilever, I am told. Is that about right? Close enough. There are 25 Johnson MBAs. They're in finance, marketing, research, and development. This summer, seven Cornellians, including three Johnson School people, will be joining Unilever in full-time roles, and two Johnson School interns will hold jobs there. So we really like companies that hire our products. So thank you very much for that. We also have two of Mr. Pullman's colleagues, David Burrows, who is class of 91, who is the Vice President for Spreads and Dressings North America, and Shannon Weldy, who is in University Relations. Thank you for coming. I'd also like to welcome 50 students, approximately, and alumni who are off on a trip. We just couldn't find a time when the brand students aren't here. They are, guess where? Unilever. And they're watching remotely. They are at Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, headquarters for Unilever. And so they, along with other Cornellians alumni, are watching. So we're very glad you're here. We wish you could be with us, but we're glad you're there. So last, to introduce Paul Pullman. In 1979, Paul joined Procter & Gamble with financial assignments throughout Europe. In 2001, he became Group President of Europe and an officer of Procter & Gamble Corporation. He, in 2006, became the Chief Financial Officer at Nestle. He was named by Investor Magazine CFO of the Year in 2007 after only 1 year of being the CFO, so a pretty quick study. 2008, he became Nestle's Executive Vice President and Zone Director for the Americas, and he was named Executive Director to the boards of Unilever, two different corporations, the first time an external candidate has ever been chosen for that role, those roles, in 2008, and he became the Chief Executive Officer in 2009. He has a bachelor's degree from the University of Groningen. I don't know how to say that word, but I always try. How do you say it correctly?
I'll do it later.
You'll do it later. And he has an MBA from the University of Cincinnati. He doesn't have a Cornell degree, but he has family members who do, including another degree coming up about 5 weeks from now. Speaking of family, in a recent article, Mr. Pullman said the two most important mentors in his life were his father and his wife of more than 30 years, Kim. And Kim is here with us today, too. Please welcome Kim. He serves as the president of the Kilimanjaro Blind Trust, which is a true passion. The mission of the trust is to enhance the lives of blind children in East Africa, enabling them to become integral members of society. He is also passionate about integrating sustainability into the very core of Unilever's business and strategy. And he's going to tell you about that himself. Please welcome Paul Pullman. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks, Joe, for the kind words. And whilst my son is able to graduate from this wonderful institution, he's never given a lecture. I won't be able to graduate, but at least I can give the lecture. But I was just looking at some other wonderful people that gave the past distinct lectures, and I see William Weldon or Irene, and Anne Futch. Anne Futch is actually a wonderful lady. She was the chairman and CEO of Young and Rubicon, and actually just decided to join the Unilever board. So it's good to see that some other board members are actually participating in the lecture series as well. Can you hear everything okay or not? Yeah? Perfect. Okay, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity once more, and welcome as well to the 40 or 50 students from the Marketing Immersion course. We saw them driving off in the red bus yesterday night when we arrived on campus, but they were too late. They sort of wanted to escape when they saw me coming on campus, I guess. So we caught them again and we brought them to the Unilever offices. So that's what you call a captive audience. But and then obviously David and Shannon being here with us is appreciated. Gail is so nice to take care of us today. We had a wonderful luncheon with Sajin, with the group of very engaged students, and made a little video for on leadership that hopefully is of use to the campus. And now the lecture, so I'm glad we have that opportunity. It's a pleasure to do this for two reasons, obviously, and I'm glad we could make it work. The first one is it gives me the opportunity to do a little bit for the university, which obviously has offered a lot to my son, Christian, who's studying here and graduating, and it obviously is a wonderful opportunity as well to see him and be here, albeit only for 24 hours. But any excuse we can find, we take, I can tell you. And another is the privilege to be on this podium, because I know, looking at the list, that you had a lot of distinguished other people talk to you, and to be here is an honor for myself. I understand that Mr. Durland himself was actually the former treasurer of the university and also the CEO of the First Bank of Ithaca. And I certainly hope that as a financial expert, which he undoubtedly was, that he will certainly approve of the topic which I've chosen to speak. In my experience, in fact, the best and most thoughtful finance people have always looked at creative business models that endure and that are sustainable. And I think there are many examples of that in the all too, unfortunately, recent history where that was not the case. I plan to tackle the topic in about three parts, if I may. I will start by giving Unilever's perspective on the social and environmental challenges which will face us in the coming decade. Then I'll move on to outline how we as a company, Unilever itself, is preparing itself to grow and prosper in what most likely will be a very different world as we move forward. And finally, I will try to define some of the essential elements of this new sustainable model we're talking about, which I believe many of us, if not all of us, will have to adapt in the future to be successful long term. But first, for the ones who don't know our company, let me briefly introduce ourselves. We're small farmers, or grocery store, as I call it, and we like to keep that small mentality. We're a company that actually makes everyday consumer goods products, like soaps, shampoos, toothpaste, detergents, tea, mayonnaise, margarine, ice cream, and the list goes on. In fact, you probably know us better by our brands. Brands like Dove's, Hellmann's, Axe, Lipton, Suave, Breyers. The most favorite, which always gets a smile, is Ben & Jerry's. And then brands like Pond's, Skippy, etc. These brands are actually sold in about 180 countries worldwide. They generate about $60 billion in turnover. And are present in about 7 out of 10 households worldwide. And any given day, we will have about 2 billion people using our products. So that's a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous responsibility I'll talk about a little later. Here in the US, the Unilever name is less known. It's probably one of the best-kept secrets. I was talking to the students over lunch, and I say, when I come into New York and I tell them Unilever, they say, Uni who? But when I tell them Ben & Jerry's, I get my stamp right away and come into the country. Usually they ask for a coupon. I didn't know you could bribe them, but they they want a coupon as well. Despite the fact that we're not totally known as a company here, we have a turnover of $7 billion in North America alone, and that's quite a sizable business. It's probably the second or third biggest consumer goods company here as well, and with the brands that will be in millions of American homes. Let me just show you a quick compilation of the brands that we have. Okay, give you a little bit of a flavor of some of the products that we have. And many of these brands have been around for decades, and we certainly have as an objective that they will be around for hundreds and more years. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what has to be done to ensure that these brands remain relevant, that the company remains relevant and appealing in the 21st century world, which will be a different world, undoubtedly, from the one that we're inhabiting right now. So let's just explore that question a little bit. In fact, the U.S. Army War College, which is here in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has coined the acronym. It's kind of an awful acronym, in my opinion, but they've coined it to describe this future world. And they call it FUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. Very much the skills that we all need to have to succeed in this future world. Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. The Army's description is right. And it's probably not the world that many of the current leaders will feel comfortable in. CEOs actually don't like volatility. They would rather have smooth progression. They would prefer predictability over uncertainty, and certainly simplicity over complexity. And ambiguity is something which we seek to eradicate. We try to do that by giving organizations a clear sense of purpose and direction. Now, in Unilever, we've tried to make sense of this very uncertain world that we are seeing, not by seeking to predict the future, because frankly, that is impossible in my opinion, but by identifying the major trends that will shape this future. As a company which has existed over many centuries, in fact, the company was born in the Depression or the Recession of 1930, we have had many experiences of dealing with these uncertainties over the years and navigating through them. Now, there are three big phenomena which I believe would be worth sharing with you that have a profound impact on how we and Unilever will do with its business in the years to come. The first of these is the shift of the economic power to the east and, to your credit, also to the south. I call it the power of the BRICS, to be honest. One of the books that you might want to read is called The New Asian Hemisphere. It came out about a year ago, and it's written by Kishore Mahbubani, who is a professor actually in Singapore. It's worth understanding this power shift that is happening. China, India, Indonesia, Russia, Brazil will certainly increasingly take the center stage in this new world that we're talking about. These countries are already and will increasingly become home to the world's most highest population, and certainly much of the economic growth. Companies like ours will have 75% of the growth in these companies already. Just India and China alone have nearly 500,000 students graduating in engineering every year. And these countries also soon will have the biggest share of the world R&D. The impact on companies like ours will be profound. The center of gravity of our businesses will indeed move eastwards and southwards, if we like it or not. 10 years from now, the percentage of business that we have in these countries will move from the 53% that we have currently to well over 70%. By 2020, as much of that 70% as a result will be outside of Europe or North America. Undoubtedly, manufacturing will move east at a rapid rate to make use of these opportunities. We're currently, as a company, building 27 factories, all in these emerging markets. And last but not least, a lot of our cultural questions need to be asked, management structures need to be asked, recruiting to ensure that we are desired employers in these parts of the world as we need to fill our talent pipeline. The second big trend, which is not a surprise to you either, is the shift of power to the consumer. I call it the consumer in charge. The digitization that you see of society and media is certainly giving an enormous power to individuals. The proliferation of the search engines that go with it, the cheaper mobile devices that are now accessible to anybody, rich and poor, free in many cases, gives you easy access to information. More telephones already used for data than for voice. Facebook, over 550 million users, not even counting Alibaba. I call it the third biggest nation in the world after China and India. In fact, the internet today has 1.7 billion users and is projected to have 4 billion users by the year 2020. Not surprisingly, most of them in the emerging or developing world. And I found a fairly troubling statistic from India. There's some Indians in the audience here, where I was 4 weeks ago. India already is the country that actually has more mobile phones, 500 million, than they have toilets. Now, don't ask me what they do with their mobile phones or the other things, but those are the statistics. This connectiveness obviously gives individuals and groups almost unlimited power to organize themselves and to campaign. Just look at what happened recently in Egypt or in Tunisia, where whole regimes can be brought down in a period of a few weeks. Obviously, there's income equality, there are food prices, there's youth unemployment. But I've said, and I will say it again, that more than anything, it's probably the revolution of the internet at play here. And there will be others to come. Closer to home, look at the success of your presidential candidate, Barack Obama, how successfully he used his fundraising, leveraged the internet to fundraise and get elected as president of this wonderful country. Now, consumers will certainly use this new digital power to demand change. They want to be in charge, and increasingly they are. They will demand change from the financial world, they will demand change from business, and also from government. They will insist on higher standards of ethical behavior, and it undoubtedly will result in improved corporate governance, fairer payments of taxes, equitable returns for everybody as society creates wealth, a tremendous power. The third big trend I briefly want to mention, and in my view the most important of them all, is what we call in Unilever the end of the age of abundance. It's the world of the future will be a world of scarcity. Professor Beddington, who is actually the UK's chief scientific advisor, warned already a few years ago of a perfect storm coming our way in a speech he delivered about 2 years ago. He anticipated a future where most of the basic resources of food, water, and energy will all be in scarce supply. And in fact, we're seeing this already, if we like it or not. The International Energy Association is estimating that by 2030, not far away, we will need to generate 50% more energy than we produce today, just to keep the world functioning. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization is estimating that we need about 50% more food than we harvest today to feed the world at that time. And for water, as you probably know and read daily in the papers, the challenges are as demanding. At the nexus of all of this is the climate crisis and driving the change in climate. Obviously, the population, the 2 billion plus people that still have to come into this earth, are part of that. In fact, by 2050, there will be 2.7 billion people more on the planet Earth than there are today. Now, do the arithmetics. 2.7 billion people more. We live in London. That's the size, that's the equivalent of the city of London created every month for the next 40 years. Or if you put it in another way, that is the equivalent of two Indias, or an India and a China, and I'll throw an Indonesia in there for free. Since we're in consumer goods, we like to do that. Now think what this means, think what the stress, the pressure that will come on the provisions that we need for food, for water, for sanitation, basic hygiene in major cities like Calcutta, Istanbul, Shanghai, and many others. Think equally of the challenges that that creates in this growth to ensure that it is equitable growth. Sustainability challenges and the equitability challenges will be the biggest in the next decades to come. It will require, without any doubt, a different response from the world's big corporations. Business as usual will simply not be sufficient. After all, that got us to the situation that we're in today. And at Unilever, we've decided a long time ago that we will want to be part of the solution to these problems. And we do believe that we as companies, not only Unilever, but as companies, we have a contribution to make. We've laid this out in a strategy which we call the Compass. The Compass describes our ambition to double the size of our business whilst reducing the overall environmental impact. In fact, decoupling growth from environmental impact. I'm not aware of any company, of our size at least, that has made that commitment and has made that commitment so publicly to do that in the next decade. And yet, it is badly needed. Doubling the revenues of a company as big as Unilever is a tall order. We're well aware of this. By doubling it, whilst at the same time more than halving the environmental impacts, which for us also means social, is obviously a really tough challenge. Yes, it does mean leaving the world in a better shape than we found it. This film explains, in fact, how we try to do this or why we try to do this, looking at the total value chain. Many companies talk about corporate social responsibility, focusing on their shop, things under their control, their factories, their transport, perhaps their travels, their offices. We've actually taken a little bit broader approach to get a real step change. You need to take responsibility of the total value chain from sustainable sourcing of your products to sustainable living. Let's have a quick look at this movie. Okay, I guess you get the idea. We tried to keep it deliberately simple for Cornell. That's why we made the drawings. But I'm sure you understood the message that we're trying to pass here. The Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, we actually launched this in November, and it's the new business model that we're talking about of decoupling this growth from the environmental impact. It's unique in three ways, in my opinion. First of all, obviously, it's a whole business model, but there are three elements that are important. The first one is it spans everything we do. All of our brands, 180 of them, all of our countries, no exception. Secondly, when it comes to the environment, the plan, as you saw, covers everything, not just only our own shop, but all of the total value chain from sustainable sourcing to sustainable living. And thirdly, it's just not about the environment alone of sustainability, but it's also about the social and economic dimensions. That's very important. The products make a difference also to people's health and well-being, and the supply chain itself provides livelihoods to millions and millions of people, which is increasingly more relevant in the emerging worlds, especially to address these issues of income inequality. The plan itself has three overarching goals that we try to deliver by the year 2020. First, to halve the footprint. Second, to source 100% of our agriculturally based materials sustainably, something that you might find relevant here as well with your institution that you have here. And thirdly, to help 1 billion people, to take actions to improve their health and well-being. Now, since we have 2 billion people using our products today, we're fairly confident that we can make these commitments, which well exceed a commitment that any individual company could get even close to. I do not intend to take you through all the details of the plan. That wasn't the purpose of the talk. But if you're interested in that, there are some booklets here, I noticed, and there is also a website that you can see. Now, what I want to do is to explain very simply why this sustainability vision is so central to Unilever's strategy and how it actually will help us achieve our growth objectives of doubling our business. It's actually a catalyzer for growth. Let's talk the strategy point first very briefly. If corporate strategy means anything, it means having a point of view about the future. and positioning yourself as a business to take advantage of that future, and to take advantage of that future in a sustainable manner. We know the outline of what the future will look like, more or less. We called it this VUCA world that I talked about, where 9.6 billion people will put huge pressure on agriculture, water supply, and biodiversity. In fact, WWF, the World Wild Fund that you're familiar with, estimates that even today, this world, this planet Earth that we're living on, consumes the resources at a speed faster than the planet's natural capacities to replenish it. We're already doing this as we talk. In fact, they calculated that if the whole world currently already would consume at the levels of what we're consuming here in the US, we would require 5 planets already. If it's in the UK, where I live, it's 3 planets. As a world in total today, we're already consuming 1.3 planets. We cannot, as I've said many times, keep stealing from future generations, your generation, your children. Unfortunately, we only have 1 planet. I think we can agree on that. In fact, it's very sad to see that even in today's world, a cat in Europe has already a higher environmental footprint than a human being in Africa. And this is before the 2.5 billion people come into this world, before many improve their standards of living as they aspire to the same quality of life that we have become accustomed to. It just cannot go on like this. I believe that companies like ours and others are uniquely well placed to do something about this, because we have the operating principle to be around for many years to come. And it's very important for companies to be sure that the environments in which we operate function. I always say a company cannot succeed in a society that fails. There are many examples of that. Have a look at this little film.
Samuel Vandenberg opened the world's first factories to make margarine an affordable and healthy alternative to butter. In the UK, William Lever opened a factory near Liverpool to produce Sunlight, the world's first packaged laundry soap. A few years later, he launched Lifebuoy, the world's first health soap. Lifebuoy played an important role in preventing disease and promoting hygiene in Victorian Britain. A role it still plays today, but on a much larger scale around the world. In the 1960s, we developed the first margarines to help maintain healthy cholesterol levels, well before worries about heart disease became a public concern. In 1995, faced with declining fish stocks from overfishing, we joined forces with WWF to create a Marine Stewardship Council. At the same time, we started our Sustainable Agriculture Initiative. Working with farmers and suppliers, we developed a set of sustainability indicators that became our Sustainable Agriculture Code. In 2004, our ice cream business worked with Greenpeace to develop ice cream freezers using natural refrigerants. In 2007, we launched Small and Mighty concentrated laundry detergent in Europe. This enables people to wash clothes at lower temperatures, reduces packaging, and cuts carbon. 2007 was also the year we committed to sustainably sourcing all the tea that goes into our Lipton and PG Tips tea bags by 2015. So far, all the tea bags we sell in Western Europe are 100% Rainforest Alliance certified. In 2008, we became the first large company committed to buying all our palm oil from sustainable sources by 2015. To date, 30% is covered by green palm certificates. And in 2010, Ben and Jerry's announced that every ingredient that can be fair trade, from nuts to sugar and bananas to cocoa, will be certified by 2013. There are many parts to our sustainable growth story. The Unilever Sustainable Living Plan is the next chapter.
Now, the business case for sustainability is getting strong and fortunately stronger by the day. Last week, I was in Amsterdam giving a talk to a group of investors, SRI, they call it, socially responsible investors. About 7% of the total wealth in the world is already invested that way. And their estimates, which I think is probably true, that will be about 20% by the year 2015. In fact, the case for this is based on five simple premises. The first one, it starts with all of us, the consumers. I don't have to tell you that. That might be a small, but it's a fast-growing group of consumers around the world who want reassurances, not only that their products perform, but that they are ethically and responsibly sourced. They're choosing to buy brands with Rainforest Alliance certificates or like Fair Trade you see in Ben & Jerry's. For this group of consumers, more sustainable brands is often a more desirable brand. Few of any consumers will accept the trade-off in price or performance or convenience. We understand that. But if we can hold these things and deliver on those premises of price and performance, then the environmental and social benefits will often make the difference. In fact, increasingly, consumers, whilst they focus on value, will also look at values, as far as I can see. A brand that has been doing that very well, its whole premise is built on this over the last 20 years, is the Ben & Jerry's. Take a look, actually, at how they are presenting the fair trade, moving their total business to fair trade to the consumer. Have a look. Now, benefits of this kind being promoted, as you see here in Ben & Jerry's, will increase in relevance without any doubt in the years to come. We see that with Ben & Jerry's, a brand rapidly approaching 1 billion euros in turnover. And brands that are first and connected with consumers to get that message across and will obviously have that trust and authority that gets translated into business results. It's very interesting. Ben & Jerry's is an ice cream, as you've all discovered. It's a total carbon neutral model. All the ingredients is totally fair trade and sustainable. In fact, in one of my interviews, I mentioned, and that was a mistake, that I'd love to be a Ben & Jerry cow because they get massaged every day, if you wouldn't believe it. And as a result, their milk quality and their milk yield is significantly higher, and the list goes on. So you see, the business case for consumers is not difficult. The business case for customers is not difficult either. We have to deal with customers, our retailers, and they also want it. They have set very ambitious sustainability goals of their own. And they need the support, obviously, of big suppliers to deliver on that. Take, for example, Walmart. You've seen their commitment to sell product that sustain people and the environment in a very progressive way here in the United States. And they need products to support that ambition that they've put out there. It's a key element of our working with the Walmarts of this world that they chose to elect us as Supplier of the Year for 2010, and we certainly have the ambition to have that same recognition in 2011. A very important part of why you want to build sustainability as a core of your business model is actually that it drives innovation. It sets the bar higher. Sustainability is an incredibly fertile ground for product or packaging innovation, if you want to. It allows you to deliver new products with new benefits at a much higher level. It sets the bar 10 times higher than the normal, slightly improved type things that the industry has become accustomed to. A good example of that is one of our fabric softeners, Comfort One Rinse. Doing the laundry in many parts of the world is a very water-intensive process. Curiously, most of that water, believe it or not, is not used for washing, but it is used for rinsing your clothes. Comfort One Rinse enables consumers, more relevant in many parts of the world where water is stressed, to rinse the laundry with one rinse instead of three rinses. Now, in countries where water is scarce, which are now many places in the world, this having to avoid walking back and forth to the well, cutting down on the tasks, is a very, very meaningful consumer benefit. Not surprisingly, a product like this is growing very fast. Another product we launched is a product called Purit that we launched in India and now being expanded across the world, which is a water purification product. The lack of safe drinking water is a major problem, not just in India, obviously, but in many parts of the world, especially where you see this population increase. The Purit in-home water purifier actually kills all harmful viruses and bacteria to provide safe water. The unique feature is that it also takes the arsenic out of the water, which is a big issue in many of these countries. You can literally take water from the Calcutta sewer, pour it in, and drink it. In fact, I wanted to do a demonstration like this the other day for our investors in London, and I was ready to drink it. But the water was so polluted that the UK government didn't allow us to import it. So I put it through the filter before importing it, and they had never seen such clean water coming into the UK. It is cheaper than boiling water and 15 times less expensive than bottled water. So we aim to deploy this technology, for example, to reach about 500 million people by 2020. And in the process, build a complete new market for us. It will definitely be one of the 1 billion plus products that we will be selling before the end of this decade. Another reason for sustainability, that's the market growth dimension that obviously the business needs. Over half of our sales, as I mentioned, are in these developing countries. These are places that are most impacted by the stresses put on this environment. And obviously addressing these issues allows you then to sell your products there. These countries will continue to be a major growth market. So if we want to sell the products today, we need to be sure that the environment is conducive for that. Also, as I mentioned, it's not only about the environment itself, it's about nutrition and health as much. So a great example of that is one of our soaps, Lifebuoy soap. Lifebuoy's mission is to build awareness in the world of basic hand washing amongst young children. And that's a habit that is not yet firmly ingrained, even in the developed world, but certainly not in the developing world. As a result, about 6 million children die every year from infectious diseases. Diseases like diarrhea and other things. More than AIDS or TB. Half of that could be cut down by just getting them into washing their hands. It's as simple as that. And I'm talking about people losing their lives. I'm not talking about the millions and millions of people in these emerging markets that don't go to school because they're sick. The chances that you give people to advance just by simply teaching them how to wash hands are enormous. So we've done about 150 million in India alone, country of over 1 billion, and we've made a commitment to reach about 500 million people. A sustainable solution to these challenges, creating a sustainable market at the same time for our products, is the sustainable model that we're talking about. The last but not least, the most obvious one is probably the one that you all know. If you do the right thing and you plan for it in advance, it can actually save you money. Over the last 5 years alone, if I just look at energy in our company, we've saved about $300 million by just cutting our carbon footprint by about 40 to 70%, depending on the places. Because the business case is strong for sustainability, what I'm trying to tell you about, it is built into all of our aspects of our business. It is our business model. It is just not anymore a nice thing to do or an add-on. It is the business model. And that's what we're trying to tell many other companies, recognizing that we alone cannot have the bigger impact that is needed for this world. A small contribution, but we want others to join. I want to conclude by describing some other features very quickly which characterize this new business model, which I undoubtedly see emerging over the next decade. First, in order to put this into practice, companies will have to recognize that building shareholder value for the long term can only be successful if it builds what Michael Porter called in one of his recent articles in Harvard Business Review, shared value. In fact, what Michael Porter is preaching is nothing different than the founders of these companies when they started their things in the 19th century were saying. Businessmen like William Lever in our company, or George Cadbury, or Milton Hershey, all practiced this shared value concept. These early entrepreneurs already recognized then that their success of their companies was intimately bound with the success of their customers, their employees, their suppliers, and with society at large. Now, not having the benefit of a Cornell MBA at this time, they intuitively understood that if they looked after these stakeholders, then the investors and shareholders would prosper too. But they didn't work for the shareholders. They worked for the stakeholders. And by serving the stakeholders, the result would be that the investors or the shareholders would be satisfied. And that is the move from shareholder value to shared value that underpins our strategy and philosophy. Now, more than ever, I believe that businesses need to connect their financial success or their long-term success to societal progress. No longer is it sufficient to purely work for goals like profit or market dominance or shareholder return. This doesn't work anymore. I believe we're moving into an age where society and the environment are shifting from being servants of the economy to the economy itself being a servant of society and the environment. Businesses like ourselves not using the economy and the environment, but businesses like ourselves contributing to make the environment and the economy better. It's a 180-degree difference from the premise on which many companies currently operate. Now, the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan goes one step further than Michael Porter's shared value concept because it really adds the dimension of doing this in a sustainable way, which Mrs. Brundtland, who was the head of the WHO, called in her definition for generations to come. That goes way beyond the corporate social responsibility. Simple notion of leaving the world in a better place than you found it. A second feature of this new model of business is its long-term outlook I talked about. We have to move away from what Dominique Barton recently in an article in McKinsey called the quarterly capitalism. I think that tyranny of quarterly reporting, driven by Wall Street, I have to say, is distorting and continues to distort the behavior of managers and lets them take the wrong decisions for short-term reasons versus the long-term benefits. For this reason, we as a company have stopped giving guidance to the markets. We've also stopped quarterly reporting as of this year. The only company I know that actually is going out of quarterly reporting. And we have aligned our compensation plan in a drastic way to incentivize long-term behavior, something I believe many in the financial world would benefit from just 5 minutes of looking at. Now, we don't operate as a company in 90-day cycles for advertising, for production, or for innovation. There's no good reason why our financial reporting for that should be any different. For this reason, we've simply told the stock market that we will no longer do it. A third feature of this new model of business is the need to be collaborative to work with others. You simply cannot do it alone. The social and environmental issues that we face are so fast and so complex that they are way beyond the capacity of any individual or any corporation to solve that alone. It's like Einstein said, the issues that have been created cannot be solved at the same level as where they are. You have to lift that. It requires a new form of working together. We have to get accustomed to that. Issues like deforestation, sustainable agriculture, food security require multi-party stakeholders. Governments find it hard to cooperate effectively. Industries must show the way to do that. But it will require new styles of leadership and new CEOs that feel comfortable with that. Comfortable with building coalitions, comfortable with being catalysts for good. A fourth feature of the business of the future will be transparency. I talked about the digital age. It's no longer possible for large institutions, whether public or private, to keep the secrets or cover up the wrongdoings. We certainly live in the WikiLeaks world, where honesty, transparency has to be the best long-term policy. As Mark Twain once said, tell the truth. It's absolutely simpler in the end. And finally, Companies of the 21st century will have to face up to their responsibilities and obligations. We touch the lives of billions of people. We consume huge quantities of the world's resources. And yes, we also create waste. We are accountable, co-responsible for the impacts we have. And as companies, we need to recognize that. Viktor Frankl is a Holocaust victim. He's a man who wrote the book Man in Search for Meaning. Some of you might have read it. I certainly recommend it. In his book, he said something very perceptive. He said, when they built the Statue of Liberty on the east coast of the United States, they forgot to build the Statue of Responsibility on the west coast of the United States. With companies like ours having an enormous liberty to sell our products everywhere, to reach 2 billion consumers a day, soon 4 billion or more, we have to assume that responsibility at the same time. Now, I hope that this short talk, and I apologize for that, gives you a sense of how and why business will have to change very fundamentally in the next decade, why it requires a different form of leadership. Change will never be easy, we know that, but time is essential. The challenges of the VUCA world we talked about are immense. Unless we do something differently, my generation will give an uncomfortable future to yours, for which I certainly don't want to take that responsibility. As I said before, we cannot continue to steal from generations to come. As the old Chinese proverb says, unless we change direction, we are likely to end up where we are going. With that, I'll be happy to take questions. Thanks.
Products in terms of the packaging you use, materials you use, that kind of thing. I'm curious to learn more about how Unilever, what Unilever has done so far to work with other companies in the consumer goods market to kind of work in that direction, as well as to get your opinion on what can you do further to kind of engage other companies to also kind of establish sustainability rules and motivate further change in the market.
Yeah, that's a broad question, but let me just give you a few examples. You cannot do it alone, that's for sure, because some of these things are very difficult to achieve. I think one of the great things that this industry has created, which I think will become apparent in the years to come, is an organization which we call the Global Consumer Goods Forum, which actually represents about $3 trillion of turnover and the 300 biggest consumer goods companies. There's a small board which has people in there like Mike Duke from Walmart or Target, Dylan from Kroger here in this country, but Chinese manufacturers, retailers, Japanese, Europeans, and there's a board of about 50. I myself have the honor to chair the sustainability pillar of that association. And one of the things that we fairly quickly saw was the failure of Cancun coming up. After the failure of Copenhagen, many meetings preceding the climate change negotiations. There was one here in Pittsburgh in this country, in Rome, in Bangkok. I followed them all, and what was really bothering me was talking about tax rules, regulations, restrictions, limitations, cut consumption, but nobody involved the consumer in any of these discussions. As you saw from that little video, 68%, whatever the number is, influenced directly by all of us. So we said we don't want this failure. So we created the Consumer Goods Organization, not for this, but we said we need to have something concrete for Cancun. I worked with President Calderon, and we came to the conclusion that we should have the consumer goods industry issue a moratorium on deforestation. Deforestation itself, illegal deforestation I'm talking about. Legal foresting is another thing. But illegal deforestation currently in the world is 16% of global warming. It's the biggest reason of global warming. So by having the consumer goods industry issue a moratorium on not sourcing soy, beef, pulp, palm oil from illegal deforestation, you send an enormous signal into the supply chain. Not surprisingly, immediately, yeah, it's the right thing to do, but it's for all of us. Now, immediately, Indonesia, President Bambang, two-year moratorium on illegal logging in Indonesia. Main issues are Indonesia, Malaysia, to some extent Brazil. Norway putting in $1 billion to help because there's monitoring that needs to happen. Alternative livelihoods need to be created. Sustainable farming techniques need to be planned. But I'm very encouraged because this is the industry that created the EAN code, the barcode, which is the same. All the governments, which are only about 200, still can't figure out one plug in the world, as we all know traveling around. So using the power, if you want to, in a positive sense, responsibly as an industry, you can make a big difference. And that's an example how we do this with coalitions. Another coalition is very simple. To reach the bottom of the pyramid, we cannot do that alone. For example, we've set ourselves a commitment to create 500,000 smallhold farmers. Currently in the world, there is 1 billion people malnutritioned. In fact, every 6 seconds, a child dies of hunger whilst we're sitting here. And yet the issue can be solved if we wanted to. So smallhold farming is one of the most effective ways of addressing these issues. Not only do these people create their own food when they are smallhold farmers to feed their families, hence solve some of the problem we talk about, but also microeconomies that can that work. Now, for that, you need market mechanisms to create demand for these products. Companies like ours can commit to some of these things, but you need to work with the Oxfams, for example, as organizations, an NGO in this case, some of the UN organizations that we work with, to help on the ground make these projects come alive, to reach these people, often in environments that businesses cannot start by themselves. So it's only by working this value chain cooperatively that you can solve these serious problems. And I could, you know, I couldn't go on. We're now making I promised Ban Ki-moon to make a paper for him in September. I'm working it a little bit with some people on how the private sector can work better with all the UN organizations. Because the UN has a major challenge coming up. I know in the US the UN is not so popular, but frankly you have to be careful by always saying if you abolish something, what is the alternative? So I'd rather say how do we make the UN work? And governments have pressure on their budgets, they care about their own things, election cycles. The UN will increasingly have to look at private sector partnership, public-private partnership, to move a lot of these projects forward. And there's a lot of wonderful work going on by the UN organizations in countries. If we can design a system of better cooperation between all of us, we could lift that to a significantly higher level. That's another example. The last one I'll quote is we are going to the G20. They've created the B20 for businesses. And I'm leading a task force on food security. This time it's in France. What can we do very practically to alleviate the food security issues? It's on everybody's mind, the fluctuations that we see in input costs now. And again, it's the poor on the bottom of the pyramid where often 80, 90% of their income goes to food that suffer. And when you see prices going up and the shocks that we currently have, you have to find ways to better deal with that in the future. Otherwise, a lot of people will suffer increasingly so. So those are some examples. Sorry for the long answer, but...
You were planning to double the revenues of Unilever over the next time horizon, but how does that work with the end of an era of overabundance? I obviously understand that the developing world is going to be purchasing a lot as they gain more in economic power. Do you see that there is going to be a shift away from consumption in the developed world so that they're buying fewer of your products? Or how are we going to balance the need for growth in business with the need for reducing consumption in society?
Yeah. See, what is happening is It's a good question, because what is happening is currently 6 billion consumers consume one. In fact, they consume 1.3 hours. 6 billion consumers consume one, right? What is going to happen is 9.5 billion consumers are going to consume two. All the emerging countries, which is 80% of the world population, by the way, even if they come to 80% of our standard of living. So 9 times 2 is 18, 6 times 1 is 6. So the pressure on this earth will be triple because of this. That's really the issue. Now, there are people that say we can solve it by consuming less in these parts of the world. I'm sure we can in some places. We can consume less. If you look at the individual categories of products, you might ask yourself, do we need all of this? But you will not solve the problem by consuming less. Nor will you solve the problem by telling that part of the world, well, you can't live like we live. Too bad. You were born in the wrong place. Doesn't work. So what we are advocating is, to a lot of the people that say you have to consume less, I say you're a little naive on the realities of the world. But what you can do is consume differently. And that is what this model is trying to address. We can consume differently. You can construct businesses where you consume more or better by using less. A typical example that you will understand right away is in the music industry. When I grew up, we had these big record players. You had to be bodybuilders to carry around 5 of them. You had to be in a house that the room was big enough for the thing to play. And then the CD came, and I thought that was the end of it. Nobody could invent something better than the CD. Now when I ask Christian or others, he looks at me and he says, what's a CD? But people are now using that music in higher proportions digitally. So they consume more, they're happier, although in some of the music I have my questions, but they consume more. They consume more by using less resources. So consume differently is what we are saying. Sourcing sustainably is a big part of that. And that we can do. And the beauty in the emerging markets is you can design that from the start. China is moving quite rapidly to green energy. In fact, half the windmills are already made in China. So they're exporting now the solar technologies. They're in India. It has moved directly to there's no landline, it has moved to mobile phones. They are jumping. The beauty of emerging markets is, if you design it in well right now, you can do a lot. Perhaps not handle all of the problems, but within our sphere of influence, quite a lot of the issues.
I'd like to echo the gentleman up here's sentiments and say thank you so much for being here today. You've talked a lot about income inequality, and income inequality is often seen globalized economy as an opportunity to control labor costs. And I think you've rightly and very passionately suggested that there are real problems with that. So how can a company like Unilever or other companies that hopefully will join and lead someday maintain their competitiveness against competitors who aren't necessarily so devoted to income inequality?
Yeah, sure. And that is a challenge. But it's more than just income equality or not, because often we would operate as companies, and there are companies like P&G or Nestle and Johnson & Johnson and many others I can mention that are equally responsible. We are operating under global standards. I cannot stand here as CEO and say I'm going to treat an American differently than a European or a Chinese or a Brazilian. So safety in our factories, environmental standards, so they all have to be global. And there are costs of doing that. I found in my 30 years in the industry that doing the right things for the long term is always better. You might not have all the short-term opportunities, but long-term it always pays out. So as we build these models for the long term, I'm not so worried about that. We work a lot with governments bringing in the standards. It is seldom that I go to a country and not see senior leaders in the government to explain to them, or at least give our points of view, be it on counterfeit, be it on legislation that is dysfunctional, be it on standards, on environmental standards that need to be put in place. And they are receptive because they also understand that in an increasingly interconnected world, there are also demands on them on what acceptable standards are. The Chinese export industry would otherwise not work anymore. So you see improvements continuously. There will be differences in standards of well-being and income. The difficulty is you have to stay competitive in the countries that you are. But we tend to try to be in products and in services that we offer where the labor component is perhaps, at the end of the day, only 15 or 20% of what we do. So even if we would be having our health plans or three times the minimum wage, I think we can deal with that by being in the branded goods. If you would be in a commodity side of the business, I think you'll have a little bit more of a challenge having to be a low-cost model. But even then, we would work hard to get the standards up to level those playing fields. But it's difficult, and there's a lot to do in the world. I'm not preaching here a perfect world at all. But we know what needs to be done, and you have to just keep working away on it. And every visit I have, that's a little victory, you know. More important than just gaining market share or having a good quarter is to have these standards. I've seen quite a, in our job, we are fortunate to travel around to a lot of places. I could have never afforded that myself, and get to places, meet people that you otherwise don't meet. But one thing I've learned is that where brands cannot compete freely, people suffer. You go with me to Zimbabwe, you go to North Korea, you go to Cuba, you go now to Venezuela and some other places where brands cannot compete. The ultimate form of democracy is for people to choose their leaders, but also choose how they want to live, their products. And so creating an environment for brands to compete is very, very important to make these economies grow. And that's obviously one of the things that we have to help people over and over see and educate them to some extent with some humility.
We have time for one more question.
Thank you so much for being here. My question is about the guidance that you stopped giving to Wall Street. I wanted to know a little bit more about the response of the financial community when you announced that, and how can companies move away from placing so much weight on financial results and financial measures for performance?
Yeah. There are some challenges because it's an important part. In fact, when we stopped giving guidance, I did that when I came in as a CEO right away because I thought I only have one shot at it. And I might as well take it now. And since I was just hired, they're not going to fire me right away. So you have to time these things in life. I got a letter from Warren Buffett. He said, that's a great thing you did. And he said, I just want you to know I've never given guidance. I got some letters from other CEOs that said, wow, that's courageous that you did this. Why did you? Or how did you do this? I said, how we did this by just saying we don't give guidance anymore. And we've been seeing a few other companies joining, but not enough in my opinion. There are some challenges. The lifespan of a CEO is fairly short these days. I've only been CEO for 2 years, which means I have 9 more months left. My wife will be happy to hear that, to be the average statistic. So that doesn't make you want to stick out your neck that easily. Then a lot of the incentive systems in the financial world are short-term incentive systems. That doesn't help either. So we have to work and change these. But I'm encouraged because increasingly companies are required to publish. You take the Carbon Disclosure Project now. There's 4,500 companies on there. And most of the top companies in the world that you would know that report on their carbon footprint, on a standard way of disclosing. And increasingly, smart investors don't buy you because you are reporting on these things, but they say if you have a good strategy, if you're in the right categories, if your brands are strong, and you think about the issues of society, you most likely have a better strategy because you've thought about these issues and internalized them. So more likely you're going to be around for a longer period of time and create value. So we actually spend a lot of time, I spent myself a lot of time to disinvite shareholders that are not aligned with our strategy. I don't really want hedge funds. One of the things we abolish quarterly reporting is to get rid of the speculation around the announcements, basically hedge funds. And we spend a lot of time trying to get the long-term investors to be interested in our model. Now, the reality is that our share price has gone up 50% over the last 2 years. And I think it has something to do with just doing the right thing for the long term allows us to more clearly communicate also our long-term strategies. And then increasingly targeting and attracting the shareholders that are willing to be with that. One of my first meetings with shareholders was happened to be in New York, doesn't matter, when I go on the roadshow. And there was this guy, you don't give guidance anymore. I cannot hold you accountable. And you work for me. And, you know, I told him that in the Netherlands, where I come from, child labor was abolished and slavery was abolished long before he was born. So this whole notion of you work for the shareholder is a wicked notion. It's a wicked notion if you think about the fact that 20 years ago, the average shareholding would be 7 years. Today in the FTSE 100 in the UK, it's less than 5 months. It's a wicked notion if you realize that 70% of the share trading happens now with day traders in seconds, all electronically. Who are those shareholders? Which interests do they represent? How can you make long-term contributions to society if you want to just only look at short-term optimization and move money around like this and that? Who's going to internalize the externalities that need to be dealt with? You see, one thing that happened in the crisis of 2008 is that people started realizing that you need financial institutions, you need grease on the system, but that's not value creation, that's value enabling. So it goes back to these companies that have the longer term, built to last versus built to sell. Those are the ones, and many others, fortunately, that are the fabric that makes society tick. That's why it's interesting in Unilever, we have frozen salaries for 3 years. We have tremendously higher targets that we set. People probably work harder than they've ever worked before. But our engagement scores are up significantly. And the reason for that is because people want to be part of a movement that is a contribution to making this world a little bit bigger than they found it. The purpose and the mission of the company is more important than someone's individual victory. And as you go out and look for companies to work, look at companies that have the same values that you have. I'm not saying that our values are the right ones. They are what they are, and others are probably as good or different. But be sure that you find companies that have values that you represent so that you feel comfortable, and then you unlock your passion to contribute to making this world a better place now and for generations to come. With that, good luck with your studies, good luck with the final exams, and make the best of it. The world needs you.
Thank you very much.
You are all invited to a reception in Sage Hall, which will follow immediately. Thanks to Unilever for hiring many of our students from Inglewood, and especially to Paul Coleman for such an inspiring class.